Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Many of us likely have memories of playing board games as kids, either with friends, siblings, or as a family. And as adults, we might occasionally play board games with our children or grandchildren. For millions of Americans, board games play a more prominent role in their entertainment and social lives. People collect board games, have regular game nights, or even travel to game conventions. Even with the growth of the video and online game industry, board games remain popular. Today, we're going to talk all things board games, how the industry has evolved, how games are developed, and what our game selection and playing style can reveal about our personalities. We've invited a panel of game enthusiasts and developers to join us, but we also want to hear from you. What are your memories of playing board games as a kid, or what kinds of games do you enjoy now? You can join the conversation at 866-999-4626, or you can send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Joining us, David Alexander. He's assistant principal at Monomoy High School and a lifelong lover of board games. When not playing music with his friends, he's most likely trying to persuade his friends or family to play games like Monopoly or Risk. He's also the host of the Man About Town podcast on WOMR, where he interviews local notables about their lives and careers on the Cape. Hi, David.
Good morning, everybody.
Dr. A.J. Ballou is a historian, teacher, and writer who currently works for an educational technology company. He lives on the Cape. His interest in board games is purely recreational. Hi, A.J.
Good morning.
Dr. Peter Evans is a historian and part-time board game designer and former staff developer at GMT Games, where he worked on games such as The Weimar Republic, Congress of Vienna, People Power, and Mr. President. He joins us from the UK. Hi.
Hi. Good to be here.
And Ethan Dowie is founder and CEO of Indigo Promotion, a lifelong board game enthusiast. Ethan enjoys how games bring people together and challenge the way we think. Hi, Ethan.
Pleasure to be here.
All right, so games like Monopoly and Risk have been around for generations, and it's likely that 30 or 40 years ago, most households had the same cache of board games, but that's changed significantly over the past few decades. So what are the factors that have contributed to the expansion of board games? Anybody who wants to start. Go ahead, AJ.
So I was thinking about this recently, the designer of Settlers of Catan passed away a couple of years ago. And I think in the United States, at least, you can measure modern board gaming by when Settlers of Catan became popular. So it was released in 1996, but it really started gaining steam in the early 2000s. A lot of people in Silicon Valley were playing it in the, 2006, 2007. And it started this trend toward what's called Euro games. So think about less luck involved, more interaction between players, and what's called abstraction. So thinking about sort of abstracting things and mechanics of the game, that is how you play the game. And there's also a sort of short period of time in which you can all sit down with a group of people and finish a game in 45 minutes. Something like, full disclosure, Monopoly is probably my least favorite game.
Me too.
Sorry, everyone.
I know, me too. I'm with you.
I think it's mostly nostalgia that we play it. My son loves to play Star Wars Monopoly, but Monopoly, can go on forever. And if someone loses all their money, they're out for good. Mm-hmm. But in other games, more contemporary games, everyone is involved every turn. There's a prescribed amount of time when you're playing, usually 45 minutes to an hour. And there's also lots of little bits and bobs that come with the game. So lots of little tokens and die and little men and those sorts of things sort of characterize Euro gaming in general, as we say. And that changed starting in the mid 90s, but especially in the 2000s.
Anybody else want to add anything to that? No?
A lot of themes that I think we'll pick up on, I think. With Monopoly, there's a number of things that you're introducing children to, like waiting their turn, which you might come across in things like snakes and ladders, shoots and ladders. It's also, how do you deal with the fact that chance is playing such a big role in the game and the fact that sometimes people are going to hand you money and sometimes you're going to be handing them money? So there's a lot of life lessons. I think games like Monopoly are kind of there to allow children to sit with those feelings of frustration and like limited amounts of control over what's happening to them. Whereas like the Euro game trend is, it's the opposite tendency in that a hardcore Euro gamer does not want any luck in the game. They want it to be entirely skill-based. When I say any luck, I mean, if you can calculate probabilities and more times than not come out in your favor, if you're good at doing that, then they'll like that to a degree. But it's a shift towards games that are primarily about skill.
Hmm. I know I get frustrated sometimes when it's a chance game because I'm like, wow, what about Sky? Yeah, so that's interesting. Yeah, earlier this month, the New York Times had an article titled New York City's Hottest Hangout is a 500-person board game night. People gather in Midtown Manhattan food court and play games together. Is this something we're seeing in other places? Yeah, you're all nodding your heads. David.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree with what Peter and AJ mentioned, but I would also say that what every game has in common and what sort of creates a lot of social opportunities is the narrative of whatever game you're playing. So there's sort of a rough format, if you will. There's the initial kind of buildup of, you know, what game are we going to play? There might be a little bit of, you know, reminiscing of a previous game of Monopoly or Risk or whatever. AJ's got plenty of stories about Catan, having mastered that game, at least from what he says. But yeah, then you play the game, and then after the game, there's sort of a recap. And I really love that narrative of, if it's a, you know, no matter what the game is, like, oh, the game was going this way, and then this happened. And the more, I don't know, the more flavor that gets fed into that narrative and that post-game wrap up, the more, you know, just keep fun, just keeps generating in a variety of ways, which, you know, then just sort of feeds into the next game, whether it's, you know, an annual game like our family Risk game that we have with Ethan and some other members of my family, or our monthly get together. But I'm not surprised to hear that board game cafes and stuff like that have now reached hundreds of people, because it's certainly a business format now, where you have muffins and cupcakes and coffee, and then there's, you know, people bringing their board games with them, or there's a, you know, stack of them there already.
Yeah. Ethan, what are your thoughts? Why are people more interested in board games? What's the attraction?
Well, you know, it's funny, because something even I've struggled with from the social aspect is gathering this big group of people in to play a board game for an hour or 2 hours when you need 5 to 6 people. It could be a challenge for anyone just from different schedules. So I always found that when there's one uniter of people and board game people to bring them all together on a common night, it just skips the whole difficult part about planning a board game night. Mm-hmm. And it sounds so simple, but just having that one event on the calendar could make it easier for people who love playing board games just to actually do it, because it might not go with their work schedule or go with, you know, anything that you have going on throughout the month or the year.
Yeah. There are many games to choose from, right, these days. Just a few being played at game night in New York: Catan, Splendor, Hughes, Q's, Saboteur, Nerds, Wavelength, Blokus, and Camelup. I have not heard of any one of these games, by the way. So let's talk about some of the popular and lesser known games by category, starting with hobby games. What is a hobby game? Anybody want to tell us? AJ, how about you? Tell us, what is a hobby game?
I think of hobby games as more sort of, I would say, on the nerdy end. Is that the correct way to put it? I think Peter and Dave could probably say more about what a hobby game is. But I think that is more of a hardcore strategy game. That's my understanding of the word hobby game.
So Dave, what would some of the hobby games be?
The Scrabbles.
I love Scrabble.
You know, all those games that, you know, we remember playing with our, you know, aunts and uncles and stuff like that. And that's another great attraction of board games. It just brings generations of people together. I'm up in Maine right now, for example, and I'm a friend of mine just purchased a cabin, and we were kind of opening the cabin up for the first time. And there was this like 60-year-old copy of Scrabble in the old maroon box. And immediately all those memories come flashing back to, you know, all the people you played with when you were 10 who are maybe no longer with us, but very powerful memory stimulator, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I think of when I think of hobby games. It's the games that, you know, everybody played at some point or other with somebody in their family.
I guess that's evolved as well over time, because like we do still all have memories of playing things like Monopoly. Scrabble, I think, still holds up. Monopoly, maybe less so among gamer crowds. But other games that people would have heard of are things like Puerto Rico, Ticket to Ride is very popular. Settlers of Catan has been mentioned a few times. There's Carcassonne as well, which like most people I know have played those, enjoy those. So yeah, it's kind of like, it's not hardcore, but it's the kind of game that most people can get into, but they're probably going to be initiated into those games by people who are a bit more interested. A lot of board gamers, they like to proselytize, right? They like to spread the hobby to their friends, for various reasons, because they want players, but maybe they also want to feel a little less out there. Normalize the hobby as well.
And what about strategy games? What are some examples of both lesser and well-known strategy games?
You know, it's funny. I there's always one that I bring up when we talk strategy games, and it's called Corridor. And very few people have heard about it. And it is my favorite game of all time. It's definitely up there for. And the reason why I like it is because it's so simple. The concept is just to get your pawn to the other side. But I find that the simple games can have the most strategy within because it's not luck based. It's you thinking about every single move, and one wrong mistake can lead to your complete downfall. So those are always my favorite. And I feel like there's a lot of them that are like that, but the ones that you can explain to someone very simply sometimes do have the most strategy within and the most that can happen within the board.
All right, creativity games. Would Minecraft be creativity? Would that be? That's not a. They don't play on the board. I know the kids play that on.
Yeah, definitely, because you're building things out of blocks that the game gives you, and people create all kinds of crazy stuff, artworks or machines. You know, I think they've even created a version of another computer game inside Minecraft, Doom. There's a bit of a trend for people to run Doom on all kinds of weird platforms.
And what would the creativity games on a board game be? What would be some board game creativity games? Oh, I think we lost Peter. We lost your audio there for a second. You know what? This might be a good place to take a little break so we can fix that. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll take a quick break and be right back. You're listening to The Point. We're talking all things board games this morning, how the industry has evolved, how games are developed, and what our game selection and playing style can reveal about our personalities. With us is David Alexander, assistant principal at Monomoy High School, lifelong lover of board games. Dr. A.J. Ballou, a historian, teacher, and writer who currently works for an educational technology company. Dr. Peter Evans, a historian and part-time board game designer and former staff developer at GMT Games, and Ethan Dowie, founder of CEO of Indigo Promotion. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Already got a couple emails. Darren in East Ham says, big shout out to our favorite board game player and fan favorite, Dave Alexander, the Seaside Schooler from his fans at East Ham Ace Hardware. And then we've got another email here from the Sturgis Library Director, Lucy Loomis. Just wanted to let your listeners know the Sturgis Library in Barnstable Village has a growing collection of traditional and unusual board games available to check out. Other libraries on the Cape loan games as well. Good point. Yeah, so much we can find at our local libraries. Just have to check it out. All right. So, Peter, before the break, you were talking a little bit about creativity games, right?
So one example would be a game called Scrawl, where you're tasked with drawing things and passing it around. So it's very similar to games that you may have played with just a pen and paper, but there's a little bit more in terms of how points are awarded and things like that. So yeah, there's a lot of scope basically for creativity within games, but also games that are all about encouraging people to be creative as well.
So, and then there are the games that are historical in nature, right? So what would be some examples of those?
Well, that's a loaded question, because I think we can all talk about that. And I just want to say this too. It's nice to unite two hobbies of mine. One is board games. The other one is hanging out at the hardware store. So I'm very happy to hear from my friends. I think that's where, you know, some of these traditional board games wind up taking you. You know, AJ and I and Peter and Ethan have all played these types of games together, and there's no shortage of any topic now, depending on, you know, any historical conflict probably has a board game. The Cuban Missile Crisis, the Cold War, the Civil War, World War II are kind of endlessly the basis of games.
Battleship. That's one of my grandsons.
Battleship.
Battleship.
Exactly. Well, and a lot of these newer games, Mindy, include elements of those traditional games. So, for example, one of my favorite games growing up was Stratego, where, you'd move these blocks around and you couldn't see the other person's block until you turned it around, and whoever had the higher number won the little battle. And now some of these newer games kind of incorporate that into what they're trying to do, but there's obviously a grander scope. So instead of just, battles between blocks, as we were saying before we went on, there might be lots of different things you're keeping track of, whether it's an economic aspect of the game, a political aspect of the game, a military aspect of the game. And, for a lot of folks, the more that's involved, the better, because now you have to have strategy across all three of those topics, which can be kind of mind-blowing, but at the same time, once you get the hang of it, is very stimulating because you're sort of in all these decision points throughout the time that you're playing the game, which is a lot of fun.
Go ahead, AJ.
If listeners don't know about it, there's a website called Board Game Geek, which is sort of the IMDb of board games, that people rate their board games and they put photos of them playing the board games and instructions and walkthroughs. And that's a good place to find new games and see what other people think of games, and also look up rules discrepancies, which comes up a lot in fancy games.
Yes. I was
but
gonna,
I
sometimes
think,
you've lost the instructions, right? Like Dave
yes.
up in Maine, I'm sure there's no instruction pamphlet in that old Scrabble game, right? So, yeah,
Missing
good point.
pieces,
Yeah.
no letter Z. I mean, all of
Yeah, I mean, that's the internet has made that easy to just post PDFs of all of your instruction booklets. But one of the best historical games is called Twilight Struggle, which is about the Cold War and the end of the Cold War. But for, me being trained as a historian, one thing I like is that there are the cards, there's a deck of cards that has historical events, but you draw them and they don't necessarily happen in the order they happened in reality, and you can sort of do different things than what happened historically. So it's sort of a counterfactual exercise about what happened at the end of the Cold War. And that game is probably, I think it used to be the highest rated game on Board Game Geek. It is a two-player, pretty deep strategy historical game that is also a lot of fun, and it has almost no random chance apart from the selecting cards from a deck.
That sounds interesting. All right, let's talk to Carl, who's giving us a call from East Falmouth. Hi, Carl.
Yeah, hi guys. How are you doing? I just want to give a shout out to some of both historical and educational games. I'm the historian for the USS Constitution Museum up in Boston, but also previously taught at the Sea Education Association down here in Woods Hole. And you mentioned the sort of traditional bread and butter of gaming and war gaming being these historical topics. But the diversity, you're right, that they're shown in more recent times has been really amazing. I feel like Twilight Struggle was just the beginning of that. And, more recent games, including Fort Circle Games Publications, Shores of Tripoli, which depicts the Barbary conflict that USS Constitution was involved in the Mediterranean in the beginning of the 1800s, is very similar to how you're describing Twilight Struggle with historical events on action cards that are then drawn and allow you to play that out.
Yeah, Carl, you're breaking up a little bit, Carl. I would love you. I don't want you to go. I want you to go and call back because this is really interesting. So hang up and give us a call back at 866-999-4626. That's interesting, right? I mean, I would imagine there's quite a few choices for historical based games, right, AJ?
Yes. I mean, Peter had been a designer for GMT Games, which makes these sort of deep strategy games, especially, I think, war game strategy games. And probably if there's some historical military conflict, GMT has either made it or is making it.
All right, Peter.
So.
Maybe not every, because there's so many, but yeah, the mechanic style that the caller was talking about is called a card-driven game. This idea of you usually have a choice between using it for a number of points to do actions, which could be anything generic like moving pieces or trying to do like roll a dice or something to try and do some other thing. Or you use these events that are printed on the card, and it's a great way of introducing historical content and kind of building people's knowledge of the history. And Twilight Struggle is a game that GMT put out that originally they weren't going to take until the owner kind of insisted. They saw the prototype and said, "Hey, let's just take this." And it, yeah, it was just phenomenally popular. And you can get an app now. You can get a computerized version and things. So that was a real kind of thin end of the wedge, I suppose, breaking new ground and also introducing the hobby to a lot of different people.
Yeah. All right, Carl
From
is.
there,
Oh,
there's
cool.
the desire for all these kind of niche areas, as you know, people say, like, we've got the game on this, I've ordered about this other thing, and
Yeah. All right, let's go back to Carl, who's back. Hi, Carl.
Yeah, I apologize. I don't
Oh,
know why I
much
was
better.
breaking
Okay.
up
Yeah.
there. It sounds like you were continuing on with the same thread of conversation, and I don't know where I lost you, but as a historian for the USS Constitution Museum up in Boston, we were really excited about Shores of Tripoli, a game covering the Barbary conflict in a card, card-driven kind of game, much like Twilight Struggle, came out a few years ago. And they it was able to be played online too, which led to a really amazing tournament that included all kinds of naval historians and official professional war gamers for the military all over the country. And that same company has just produced recently released Votes for Women, a game about the history of the women's suffrage movement in the United States. And soon to be released from them also is now coming The Halls of Montezuma about the Mexican American War. They're the same kind of games where you're not burying into that detail, but it's all the card driven. And as an educator, we've also used games, I've used games extensively, not only in sort of teaching content of history, but in terms of other skills development, in doing professional training for mariners down at the Sea Education Association in Woods Hole. We often run really fun versions of a game called Space Team, which on the surface is this incredibly chaotic card game in which a whole table of people are supposed to be the crew of a disabled spaceship and they have to fix all the problems, but they're only sharing one set of tools that they can't identify by name. So they have to be able to describe it and pass the cards around. And the chaos of it led to, the need to be able to communicate clearly, share that single set of tools was incredible lessons in sort of communication and teamwork. And we found it not only a ton of fun, but astonishingly valuable.
That is so interesting, Carl. Thank you for the call. That's it. I mean, great. You can learn some history from playing. People think of, oh, playing games kind of like a it's a waste of time, right? You're not really, you're just playing. But no, there's so much more. Like Carl is saying, learning that about communication and you're learning about history. So it's all good. Thank you for that. And AJ, as a historian, it must be really satisfying when you can see a game like the ones you guys are talking about that's actually accurate to history, right?
Yeah, and people get really into their specific area. So that's, I mean, that's more depth than I would know about any of these things. But I'm really looking forward to trying Votes for Women about the suffrage
Yeah.
movement in the United States. And historians talk about contingency, which is whether or not things happened the way they had to happen. And these board games are a good exercise in just figuring out cause and effect. And what if one little thing changed, then the entire course of history could have changed.
Right. Yeah. Then we also have the fantasy themed games, which I'm assuming are very popular, right? People want to escape reality. Let's go to fantasy land. So what are some of the more popular fantasy themed games?
I played one not too long ago. Our friend Jakob, who couldn't make it today, introduced AJ and I to this game called Root, which takes place in a forest, and everybody takes a different group of forest creatures, which I wasn't really interested in playing. But what I found underneath all of that was a ruthless game of manipulation, bluffing, and all the rest of it, which just makes for a lot of laughs. And I think that's one thing that's really continued to happen almost exponentially is all these different types of games, whether it was video games or games from Europe or American strategy games, they're all sort of bouncing ideas off of one another and assimilating different components into what's possible. So for example, you now have games that are maybe fantasy based, that use similar mechanics to other, let's say, war games. And then on top of it all, you might have different victory conditions than the other players. So, you know, traditional games of like Monopoly, you win with the most money or everybody else going bankrupt or whatever. It's turned on its head because now if you're playing with four people, there might be four different paths to victory. And it creates this sort of really interesting interaction as you're trying to accomplish very different things all at the same time within a single game.
Keeps you on your toes, huh?
Yeah. Whether it's fantasy or you know, a World War II type of theme. I mean, you're always going to find yourself. I used to call them chess moments, but the better description is decision points. Where you can go this way or that way. You never have enough resources to do what you want to do. You may be in a, you know, some of the more interesting games that have recently come out have put you in these co-optition points where you have to cooperate with people you're fighting against because you need them in order to do something to a third player. You know what I mean? So you can scratch the itch in a lot of different ways in a lot of different themes, and that makes for a lot of fun because now you can include anybody who's interested in any of these, you know, spectrum of topics, whether it's fantasy or strategy or war or some combination of all of them. There's sort of something out there for everybody.
Right. It can be daunting to start playing a game, especially if you're joining a group that's been playing for a while. So what advice do you have for folks who are like, yeah, I might want to try this, but all these people, have, you know, they've been playing much longer and I don't have a chance of winning, right? But you do.
Well, I think you have to be very comfortable understanding that you're going to stink at first, especially in the more complex games, because there games nowadays, the ones that Dave and Peter and AJ have mentioned, it takes a while to learn them. It's not a sit down and, you know, you just study the rule book once and then you're good. It's more so feeling it out and feeling the whole process of, oh, now I understand why AJ did this at this point in time. And what's cool about it is then you take that into the next game and then eventually you evolve into a better player. But I don't think there's any way to shortcut it. I think you have to accept that, you know, you're not going to be a good player at first, regardless of the game. Dave recently taught me how to play cribbage, which I didn't think I had any business playing cribbage at first, but amazing game. And I was terrible for the first hour. But then as you, you know, just start to go, all of a sudden things are clicking and the strategy of that specific game starts to make sense.
Yeah. Did he skunk you to begin with?
He actually did defeat me. It was a rough weekend of board games, if I'm being quite honest. But
I just keep throwing new titles at Ethan because he usually wins if he's been playing it for a while. So I'm like, oh, let's just try, you know, a series of new games where I can have the advantage. And I have fun. And, you know, Ethan gets frustrated and then wins for the next couple of years after that. But
what can board games reveal about our personalities? You know, the game we like to play or how we behave when we're playing, thinking of that person that's, you know, pretty laid back, but turns out to be super competitive when the game comes out. That's always a surprise, right?
So like Dave was saying before, it's a kind of, there's a structure, there's a ritual to playing games. You have the preamble of like choosing which game you're going to play, on which there is a concept we have of weight of board game as well. So like lighter games are considered easier to get into. That would be a good option for people that's trying to get into the hobby. And then you've got the kind of the interactions that happen within the game as well. And often games will allow you to inhabit a kind of persona. So Dave and I actually met playing a game called Congress of Vienna, where you're kind of wheeler dealing as the great powers in Europe during the Napoleonic Wars, trying to figure out how to make peace. And you're all trying to get advantage, essentially, in the kind of post-war world. And I love to play as the Austrians, who were led by somebody at that time called Metternich. And he's very famous as a diplomat. And I like that because it allows me to be a bit of a talker and to not have to pick a side. I can, like, you know, make a little deal over here. I can be talking to Napoleon and go, like, hey, you know, we can make an arrangement. And then talking to Dave, who may be the Russians or the British. And it just allowed me to be in that kind of free agent, lots of chatting to people, lots of talking and so forth. a friend of ours, Frank, who actually designed the game, would always just say he'd call me Machiavelli Peter because he'd try and disparage me and say he couldn't trust what I was saying. I was always honorable, of course. But yeah, you can definitely lean into some roles that you wouldn't otherwise get to play perhaps in everyday life.
That's part of the fun of it, right? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Have any of you ever played Romoli? Do you know that game, Remoli?
No.
See, I'd never heard of it either. And my sister-in-law is Canadian. It's a game out of Canada. And it's a mix of poker and rummy. And it is, check it out. It's a lot of fun. I haven't played it in a long time because my grandson's not quite old enough to quite get that game yet. But Remoli, if you like rummy and you like poker, it's the best of both worlds. Right? How are board games in the U.S. developed, produced, and marketed today versus historically?
I was going to mention this earlier, and Peter can really dive in because he since we initially met playtesting this game Congress of Vienna, Peter is actually designing his own games and working for the GMT board game company that was producing that. And I think it may surprise a lot of people to know that a lot of these games might take years to develop. So it's sort of a passion project. Peter mentioned the designer of Congress of Vienna. He lives in Spain, full-time job, as a businessman. That game was in development for close to 5 years. I mean, Peter and I play tested that for, I don't know, I was on board for about 6 months. Peter and I did a variety of things. We created some how to play videos and, play testing is basically, let's make sure this game works. Let's break the rules. Let's see if there's loopholes in the rules. So it can take years. And so I just got my hard copy of Congress of Vienna in winter 25. And that was, as I said, 5 years of development. So it's fascinating, and it's also, I'm sure, exhausting for designers. But
all Peter, right. I'm sure you're finding that. Peter, take us down the road. Tell us, how does this work? Yeah.
Yeah. So you got like different types of producers. So you've got companies like Hasbro, which are going to be putting out multiple titles. They have professional designers, play testers and stuff. They're much more like a kind of video games industry, I suppose. And then you've got your niche producers who are something more like GMT, are kind of on the larger end of the war game scale. And it's much more mom and pop style, right? It's a family business, family owned, family run. There's a lot of volunteer labor that goes into it. So play testers, GMT do pay their developers, which is rare in the kind of niche world. And then you've got various people who are staffers, so Kai Jensen does all the production stuff. She's liaising with the factories. She's currently looking for alternative factories right now, because you may have heard that there's a new tariff regime. Mm-hmm. And games and toys fall into the, I think it's 145% bracket. Mm-hmm. So right now, a lot of the games are being produced in China, which is where the expertise and often the high quality print works are, and also things like die cut machines, because you need really high precision to be able to print components and have it to a high level of tolerance. And a little anecdote I heard recently is when they moved to producing through a Chinese company, they said that they had to have at least 95% of the things correct, and it got lost in translation. They actually delivered them, 5% of them were deliberately defective That's what they thought had been asked for some reason. They didn't know, they didn't question, they just do what they're told. But like, what you can get out of China, like, they really do what they're asked to, essentially, like almost every time. So finding people who are used to dealing with orders at this kind of bulk at the moment is a major challenge that the hobby is facing. Yeah. So yeah, produced generally overseas. It used to be produced, say, in the US or in Europe, but globalization and lots of things were offshored. But a lot of the design work is being done kind of in the States or in European countries. A lot of international collaboration, obviously, through the internet. People can meet and come up and test games as well. So a lot of the testing actually takes place digitally now. And you'll be looking at physical components relatively late on sometimes. Different practices in different places. But yeah, it's a collaboration with a lot of people.
So is there a strategy then when you're developing these games, globally, where you market them? You're going, okay, we're going to market this in the US, or we're going to just market this in Europe? Or do they go, we're going to do it globally? How is that decision made?
I'm pretty sure most places will sell primarily to the United States because it's the largest market, and Europe, European Union. Again, different companies are going to be focused on different things. So there are niche board game developers and publishers in Spain that focus on Spanish-speaking countries, and France that focuses on France. I would say English-speaking world, you're probably looking at the United States, Australia, maybe you know, a little too far away to consider as a real consumer market worth targeting for its own sake.
We are talking about games. What are your memories of playing board games as a kid, and what kinds of games do you enjoy now? 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking board games this morning. If you'd like to plug your favorite board game, you can join us at 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or you can shoot us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. With us is David Alexander, assistant principal at Monomoy High School and lifelong lover of board games. Dr. A.J. Ballou, historian, teacher, and writer who currently works for an educational technology company. Dr. Peter Evans, historian and part-time board game designer and former staff developer at GMT Games, and Ethan Dowie, founder and CEO of Indigo Promotion. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. You mentioned play testers, and I thought, well, that'd be kind of fun. All I can think of is that movie Big, remember, where the kids playing with the toys?
Yeah.
So how does that work? They take the suggestions as the play testers test these games out, and then will they give you like a survey or something? You rate it. You're all nodding your heads. Tell us how that works. Play testers. How does that work?
Well, can I point out one thing that
Sure.
when we play tested Congress of Vienna, this was during COVID, so we played with on a virtual platform. Was it Vossel, Peter, that we used?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you put in the pieces, you sort of scan all the pieces in, you make the pictures, and then you use the rules that are created. So you can tweak the rules as you're going through, see what works and what doesn't work.
Ooh.
But one of the benefits of the, you know, COVID pandemic, if you will, is the silver lining was that everybody's more familiar with Zoom, and everybody that has started using more fully this sort of Vassal and these virtual testing sites. So people can play board games virtually, not only when they are released, but when they are testing out the rules to figure out how it works. So it's made sort of the distance less of an issue.
Oh, we've got an email from Danielle. This is a good one. Shout out to the board game Wingspan. Not only is it beautiful, but you learn all about birds. I've gained a new appreciation for ravens and crows, the most powerful birds in the game. I'm going to get that one. Wingspan. You guys know that game? Yeah, you're nodding your heads. That sounds fun. I'm thinking my grandson, Mr. Birder, he would love to play that one. If you have children or grandchildren, you've likely played your share of Candyland or Chutes and Ladders. How are games used to facilitate childhood development, both in tangible skills and social skills?
I have to give a shout out to Carl. I figured he was going to call. I bumped into him here and there throughout, you know, sort of the board gaming community, which is, it's a very tight-knit community. So, and Board Game Geek, I think, is one thing that really helped solidify that community. So it could interact and communicate. You know, that really kind of moved things along. But as a former teacher, I taught world history, I taught government, but I used, you know, Risk when we were doing the Napoleonic era. I used this game Diplomacy when we were doing World War I. So a lot of those skills that Carl was talking about, you know, in terms of getting engrossed in a historical era, you know, so for example, the Diplomacy game where you're acting as one of the World War I powers, knowing what the challenges of France and England and Russia were, and they were all different and similar, I think it really stuck. Kids understood things a lot better because they were in a simulation of sorts. You know, Diplomacy is a game that goes back to the late 1950s, so it's pretty straightforward. But as Ethan was pointing out, it's simple to learn and hard to master. So, you know, games like that as a teacher were really helpful. And then I remember the game Pit, which is a stock market game that's been around since like the 1930s. Having a wonderful time with my parents, my kids, all at once. You're yelling for I need three wheat. I'll give you two sugar, you know. And so those skills of waiting your turn, of competing in a fun way. I mean, all the people that are on this panel, I played a lot of games with, and everybody's there to have a good time and maybe win. But it's more important that you're taking a break from the world, you're relaxing. And that's a really important skill for, especially today for mm-hmm. kids that mm-hmm. you can disconnect and interact.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, the possibilities are limitless, whether you're educational or social.
You said something important there, maybe win. And I think, especially for like down to that Chutes and Ladders and Candyland, teaching good sportsmanship, right? Because kids, they want to win. And when they don't, for some of them, they don't win, they get mad, right? So I know my grandson used to get really upset because he'd be mad that he didn't win. And I'd say, now you got to shake your opponent's hand and say good game, right? Luckily, he's not a sore loser anymore. But I think it helps to teach us good sportsmanship, right? Yeah. All right, go ahead, Peter.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. And the other aspect that it tends to develop is abstract thinking, right? Coming up with a plan and executing that plan. And if you think of things like chess, you know, the game of kings.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of games were developed to enable people to think more clearly, strategically, long-term planning, all that kind of stuff. And one of the main impetuses for the modern hobby comes from actually the Prussian general staff who used to war game out their battles and stuff, and that fed in. But board games are actually thousands of years old. They found what they think are board games in, you know, ancient Babylonia and Egypt and stuff, where you're chucking sticks. And then you're moving pieces, and they're kind of like backgammon-esque, but like a lot of the things that we still enjoy about board games today, you get from those old games. It's like a structured social interaction. There's elements of drama, you know, you're ahead and then they're ahead, and you've got that kind of race element of like, are they going to make it to the end? Are you going to jump on my piece? All that kind of stuff. Like, it's just a lot of the things that we like as humans, I think, that ability to bring us together, to communicate, to tell stories.
Yeah. And people collect. I mean, as you mentioned, board games go back a long way, and some of those older board games are worth a lot of money, right? And so there's this whole business around collecting some of that as well. We also have the game conventions, and there's one coming up in May in Boston, PAX East. Who wants to tell us more about conventions? Do y'all go?
I've been to a couple. I mean, I think, again, you know, unfortunately, Jakob couldn't make it today, but he would definitely talk about he like a room in his house is just board games. Mm-hmm. You know, the four walls are shelves. There's a giant table in the middle. He grew up in Europe. He's got some medieval weaponry on the wall, on the walls and stuff. It's a thing. But he went to and unfortunately it's not happening this year due to some of the budget cuts, but at the I guess it's the Naval War College in Newport, they were doing a convention where you know, they had some folks from the Navy, they had historical tours, they played some board games. And I think a lot of the conventions just sort of bring people together that maybe you're only seeing virtually, or, you know, maybe people from local game groups are, you know, traveling. I envision it as something I would probably do more in retirement. You know, there's big ones on each coast, every year, but you know, like anything else, there's a lot of opportunity if you have the time and the resources to get there. But they'll demo games, they'll sell games. So it's really sort of almost a family reunion of sorts from you know, the different things that
mixed with the trade fair.
And for some of the board games, especially, like, I'm thinking back, you know, Battleship one, but there's also like now an online version of some of these games, right? The apps that, and I don't know how they compare. I mean, do you, it's to me, it seems like the board game in person would be the number. I mean, that's where you're really socializing and conversation. It's way different, I think, than playing games online. You're all shaking your heads, right? I mean, that's part of the whole fun of it is the social aspect, right?
I think it's different too. Yeah. It's our go ahead, AJ.
No, I was going to say, yeah, there's definitely some games that I wanted to just sort of play a game and done the digital version. And many of them are honestly very well done. They're almost exactly like their board game counterparts, and you don't have to set them up or shuffle the decks. So it becomes convenient. But like Dave was saying earlier, and everyone else, that interaction with other people is a big part of the game. So, you know, your socialization and just hanging out and talking with people while you're playing the game is really part of what makes it so fun. But, you know, I think there's definitely a place for those digital games. Go ahead, Ethan.
Even the competitive aspect as well, though, when you're in the presence of five other people and you can feel their energy when you do a move and kind of see like, oh, how did they react when I touched this piece? It's completely different than when you're online playing against someone that you maybe can't see, or it's a computer and there's no, it's almost just cold. It's just you're playing the screen and there's no feeling or energy with the whole ordeal.
Yeah, I see. That's what I'm thinking. Either like you mentioned, shuffling the cards. That's a good. When you're shuffling the cards, you're having conversation. You know, so that's what I was thinking about that. Paul writes, with geopolitical and climate threats, please have your gamers explain what they're doing to survive. Maybe that's a question for you, Peter.
Well, that is a very good question. I mean, we're doing what we do, muddling through, I guess. What are we doing to survive? Like, as an industry, I suppose people are looking for places potentially to print their games outside of China. They're looking at maybe shipping direct from China to other markets, cutting out the United States as a hub for distribution. They may be looking to fold. Unfortunately, a lot of companies, their cash flow issues have just been really badly affected, so some are just folding. A guy called oh, what's his name? I can't remember his first name, but Stegmaier from Stonemaier Games is actually starting what looks like it might be a class action lawsuit against the president. I'm not sure that'll get much traction, but taking legal action essentially for the damage that's being done. But yeah, we're a small industry. I don't suppose we're going to get the ear of the president. So yeah, as I said, also a lot of the games are being made on people's own time. So most designers are, hobby designers are going to be doing it as a passion project, and then they'll publish and they might make a little bit of money out of it. Depending on how things go with GMT Games, I may or may not be able to publish designs that I've worked on that I was hoping to get some income from. But lucky I didn't put all my eggs in that basket. So I think most people are there full time, that they'll have probably a bit more cash reserves to sit on and a bit more time therefore to retool.
Got about a minute left, Dave. I'm wondering if there are board game nights on the Cape that you're aware of, and if not, any thoughts on starting one?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of different things going on. I know there's a monthly get together at the Harwich Community Center. There's Vanguard Games down in Hyannis that I think has weekly and probably monthly get-togethers. And there's all the informal groups. AJ and I get together probably once every 5 or 6 weeks with a small group of three or four other people. So, and you can coordinate all of that just by going on to the Board Game Geek and saying, hey, who's out there? What's offered at your. And then there's people who, I think I was just at a coffee shop in Chatham that opened, and they were sort of creating a bookcase worth of games because it's just this giant there. It used to be a health center. So there's a swimming pool that's actually the seating area. It was the former swimming pool. So there's sort of this expectation now that you can go to a cafe and break out a board game and it's okay.
And that again, check out the libraries. The libraries may have some of those game nights going on. David Alexander, Dr. AJ Balub, Dr. Peter Evans, and Ethan Dowie, thank you so much for enlightening us on board games. I got a couple on my list here now that I have to go check out. Thanks for being
Good
here.
up.
Thanks for having
Thank you
us.
so much.
Thank you for having us.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.